Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Arlene Cohen.
And you're listening to the midweek version of Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who stab ground cloth to make fine art, because I'm feeling like betwixt and between here today.
That's a good combination.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Made that up on the spot, too. Yeah.
You did. I want to hear more about feeling betwixt and between.
No, you probably don't.
No,
I'm guessing you probably don't. No. It would take an hour and you'd just go to sleep. So, nah, you don't want to. So, yeah, Arlene, thanks for filling in for Christine here as we struggle through October to,
You guys and your, like, real world jobs, that is no fun, but I enjoy being a part of the conversations, and I'm glad to help out when I can.
It's much appreciated. It is. The topic of the day, I'm so glad that you have started writing a blog.
Thank you.
I say that with all sincerity, because we mentioned it a couple weeks ago that you had started doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's it, with this, the one thing that I really always appreciate about your FlossTube videos is that the teacher in you comes out and you present information. You know, there's thought behind it. There's back. Research history. I mean, all the things. And it, for me, it just makes it very meaty. Your FlossTube videos very meaty. And so I'm so glad that you're writing blogs, because that same thing is happening. And the one that you posted, we're recording a few days before this goes up, but the one you posted about hobbies, a New York Times, Tim Wu, New York Times article, is so spot on to what has been in my mind. And I'm a firm believer in hobbies because I have too many of them. But just really... really hit the spot in terms of what a hobby can mean. And because Wu starts out, "I'm a little surprised by how many people tell me they have no hobbies.
Mm-hmm.
It may seem a small thing, but at the risk of sounding grandiose, I see it as a sign of a civilization in decline."
Yeah. So just a little background. If anyone is interested, this is a blog post that's posted on my website for October 19th. And I saw a blurb in another magazine called The Week. And luckily, because of the subtitle that was given there, it drew my attention to the article in the New York Times, because the title in the New York Times would in no way have attracted me to the fact what the article was actually about, which is a whole nother topic of conversation. But the title of in the magazine I saw said, "Why People Don't Have Hobbies." And you could bet that made me pause and read, because I'm thinking, you know, that the side that I am so aware of, that I know of the non-stitching friends and family in my life who don't necessarily have. And I get stuck on the word hobby sometimes, because stitching means so much more to me than what some people think of as a hobby. But for the sake of this moment, we'll use the word hobby. I think of those who don't have something like a hobby in their life. And I get that. But I also have so many that I now know. I'm going to especially say thanks to FlossTube and the Facebook groups and Instagram and all the connections that have especially been made in the last year or so, that within the stitching world, who most certainly do have, and I'm going to say not just a hobby, but something that is so important to them. So I wanted to see the full article and to read what Tim Wu was writing about. He's writing about that from his perspective. He's seeing so many, like a few of his other comments or some of the sentences that I highlighted. The population of our country now seems divided between the semi-pro hobbyists, some as devoted as Olympic athletes, and those who retreat into the passive screeny leisure that is the signature of our technological moment. And I thought, well, no, there's a whole category of people somewhere in between. There's a whole lot of us out there that have something that are genuinely important to us. That So he also comments, there's a deeper reason I've come to think that so many people don't have hobbies. We're afraid of being bad at them. And that is so not true for the stitching world. We are so glad that we have something that we do because we enjoy. And it brings us pleasure, and it gives us comfort. I have often talked with others about the pleasure that some people get from, say, yoga or gardening or cooking or you know, pick whatever, and how I get that from stitching, and as I know, plenty of other stitchers do. And there's no being bad, being good at it. I suppose those whose hobby is something like athletics, there's a judgment, I suppose, of being, quote, good or bad. And I think one of his examples is something about running and the difference between being a casual runner and training for a marathon. Okay, if running is your hobby. But you, Gary, you talk about being on your bicycle. And as far as I know, you're not training to do any, like, crazy races or anything.
No, but it really, he hits the nail on the head, because you're right about the stitching world. There is a whole body of people who do it just because they enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But like any hobby, he's dead right. Every hobby, there is this comparison, this one-upsmanship, this competition that evolves out of it. And I think it, I agree that I think it colors, and I think it hurts hobbies in general. And you talk about my cycling. Now, there's a lot of cyclists in our area, and I could ride with groups and probably any night of the week and any day on the weekends. But I've tried it a couple of times, and immediately it sucks the fun out of it. And so 99% of the time I ride by myself. And the only time I don't ride by myself is when my sister and I do the little tours that we've done two or three times in the past years. And we both have the same approach, and she is my sister, and we just have a great time just riding. But every time that I've tried to ride with a group of cyclists, there's just this undercurrent of competition. Who can be fastest, who has the best bike, all of those things, who has all the trimmings on their bike, who has the clothes, the shoes, whatever. And, cycling is like any hobby. You can spend as much money as you want without any trouble at all. Yeah. And so I find myself just riding by myself. Mm-hmm. Because it's a hobby. It's a way to say semi-fit. It's a way to allow me to eat Mexican food and donuts, without weighing 300 pounds, But it, as a hobby, it releases me. It gets me out. It clears my mind. I sort out problems at work. I so love going on 3-hour rides, and the first hour my mind is just working 100 miles an hour on this, that, and the other thing. And then they all get sorted out. And then the last 2 hours, there's nothing but me turning the crank and the wind blowing by my ears and whatever scenery I'm seeing. And there's just nothing like it. And I have the same experience with stitching where, we were talking really strangely about this the same day we're recording this. The morning of, I did a recording with Trish Burr, and that will be up Sunday. Mm-hmm. And talking about that same thing, and taking needlework on the road when I travel. And I had a situation here a week or so ago where a flight got canceled. And it was a long day and well into the night, and I got to my room, and I had just had a small bag with some service embroidery in my backpack. And I sat down in the room, no TV, no nothing, just silence. Mm-hmm. And just sat there and just did a half hour of stitching, and it just all kind of drains away. And to me, that's the value. That's where the hobby has that real value. Yeah. And I see it all the time in hobbies, that competition, that one-upsmanship, that judging of product, judging of what you've done. And instead of just doing it just because it's just fun to do.
do you think that that competition exists in stitching?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not always verbalized, but oh, yeah, I think there's plenty of it, very much. Yeah, I think people contain it better, but no, I think there's plenty of that. Now, I think it's offset by just as much people just doing it because it's fun, just doing it because they purely enjoy it. But I do. I see it. I see the undercurrents. The read between the lines. Yeah, I see it more than I care for, but yeah.
I guess my experience with stitching, and I don't have too much experience with other stitchers. I'm thinking about being online and in groups. I see it much. I see much more the supportive, and maybe this is just what I'm choosing to see, the supportive nature of the hobby, and the cheering on that I see. I'm thinking about the experiences of when I went, the retreat that I had in May and the retreat that I then went to in June, and those experiences of being with groups of people, most of whom I didn't know at all in person, and what an amazing environment that felt. And that did not feel like, one upmanship. I mean, other than jealousy over who could spend more money over patterns. But that, I mean, I think that's more of a real world reality than anything else. I hear what you're saying about in cycling and the best equipment and more exciting, whatever. I don't see it again. I may not, we don't have the same experiences. I just have not seen that from a stitching perspective. I have seen it from just the connections of someone who connecting with people who totally get what you were describing, that release, that what you get from putting needle and thread and fabric and all of that, that excitement when you find something that you love or that just is giving you joy, and that being able to connect with others who get that same feeling. And to me, those are the dominant feelings that stand out within the stitching world. And that's what didn't seem to have a place at all in Tim Wu's article. He didn't even seem to recognize that there were any hobbies out there that could at all provide that piece of
camaraderie thing. Yeah.
Camaraderie.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there are running groups or cycling groups or whatever who truly have that camaraderie. I don't know, but I'm thinking of knitting and quilting and the fiber arts that I just think is so much more of, the camaraderie that I ended my blog post of, and I'm kind of seriously thinking about wanting to write a response to him it's an opinion piece. It's, just to say that there is a whole world out there. I'm not going to claim it's the, I don't even know what kind of percentage of the population we're talking about here, but to me, it's larger than some might think because it's part of my world and it's part of the world of a lot of people who are listening to this podcast. So a lot of people that are probably nodding right now and are thinking about the camaraderie they have with the people that they are with, or with the Facebook groups they interact with, or with the whatever ways they are able to interact with others who do what they love. If they're listening to this podcast, they probably have some kind of interest in stitching.
Geez, I hope so.
Yeah. I don't know. I suppose some way someone might be. Anyway, the point is that I just think there were so many statements in that article that there's a whole nother world of hobby that needs to get put out there to remind authors like Tim Wu that this does still exist, because I'm a part of it. You're a part of it. We're all a part of it.
Well, yeah, and that's just it. And I, you know, I say that I see the other side in this hobby, but you know, I, and I've said this before too. That's one of the things that I so enjoy. Well, about Flosstube, but particularly about Facebook groups, is and what is the positive nature and the supportive nature and the non-critical, constructive criticism and help. And I just so love it when somebody says, oh, I'm down to the end and I ran out of thread and I can't find this dialogue and this thing. And within 10 minutes, 20 people have something they'll put in the mail. You know, that is just one of the neatest things on the planet. You know, yeah, there are real humans out there that are, you know, are really willing to help each other out. And it's so heartwarming to hear that. But, you know, that's what has happened to my Facebook newsfeed. Anymore is because of all of the groups that I'm a member of, the Facebook stitching groups, and I found that as I would rifle through my feed, that it would be all these positive things and this beautiful stitching and sharing and helping, and then I'd run into to somebody who had a post about a political thing or this or that, and over time, I've just eliminated them all. I've just blocked them all out. And now my Facebook news feed is all a very enjoyable, positive thing because it's 98% needlework groups. And yeah, so that to me, because I mean, it was getting to the point where I couldn't, I wouldn't even go to Facebook because it, it was just so full of garbage, my news feed from all kinds of people. And I just started eliminating them. And now I have, it's a much better experience all the way around. And, because we have those things and I, anytime that any of the, negative side pops up in one of those groups, it is usually shot down and removed within minutes. And which is good because, you know, that's what this is all about is supporting each other. And that's what this online experience that we have with Flosstube and Facebook, is and should be all about is helping each other and furthering the hobby and having, helping everyone succeed at whatever level they want to succeed, whether it's just for fun or to be some master craftsman or, you know, whatever it might be, but to be there and be supportive. And, to me, that's just, that's what hobbies should be. Everybody getting together, having fun, enjoying the experience, whatever it might be, and learning from each other. And if you want to get better, you can learn from someone and go get better. And if you don't care, fine, you know, just keep stitching the way you're stitching, you know, as long as you enjoy it.
And we're lucky that we have something that we love. I mean, that sometimes I think about those in my life who don't have something like this and how, this is going to sound bad, but how lost they are, you know, that they don't have something to turn to. And again, it doesn't have to be stitching, but something to turn to that, that keeps them grounded or keeps them with, you know, I don't, for lack of better words, something to think about when they're stuck in traffic, something to just keep their minds open, to have in their Facebook feed besides the negative stuff. I mean, that for nothing else, that is a great example to say, whether your Facebook feed is filled with needlework or filled with, you know, pick whatever it is, that alone is a wonderful thing. And I am very appreciative that I have these things in my life that, that mean so much to me. And again, just thinking about those who are listening right now, I hope everyone like sort of takes that moment to realize how lucky we are that we have something like this. And that's why, you know, whenever I get the opportunity to, somebody shows an interest in trying to teach someone or offer, you know, a little kit or a little something and show, you know, you never know when you're going to spark an interest or spark a new stitcher. And whenever you can offer that, you know, you never know when it's going to turn into something more. Because, you know, one more person doing, finding something that they love is, you know, one better person in the world is my answer. Yeah.
Well, and I went and read that related article that was referenced in this one about the role of hobbies in our lives. And I've always been a firm believer that that's critical because I see people who don't have hobbies.
Yep.
And they don't, they don't have, it's, you know, they work and then they come home, watch TV, do whatever, but they don't have anything that stimulates the other side of the brain or gives them that release. And it lost. Yeah. I think, I mean, there's just this element. And, you know, I just think people that have a hobby that work all day and driving home, they can switch off the work because they can fill their mind with, oh, tonight I get to do my model trains tonight. You know, yep. I can't wait to get home, get dinner, and then I'm going to just go in the basement and just run my model trains and pretend like I'm a train engineer, you know, a complete escape. Yep. And I just think that's vital to us moving forward, because I think both of these articles mentioned that one of the benefits of an advanced society is that you're able to move from the simple survival activities to furthering your interests, mm-hmm. or finding new interests. And that's where the hobbies come in. And, yeah, there are people that don't have hobbies, and but it should be something you enjoy. My dad all my entire life, my dad has been a model railroad. I use model railroads because that, yeah. I just talked to my dad the other day. He's been a model railroad hobbyist. And every house we lived in, every year I was alive, there was at least an oval of a model train somewhere in the house and around the Christmas tree. And he's 85 now, and he has half a basement because he's accumulated all this stuff, and he's built it, you know. He has a half a basement full of a layout that's multiple layers. And I called him the other day, and now, I mean, he's retired. He works at a hobby shop 2 days a week, but he's retired long ago. And I said, "Hey, Dad, what's going on?" "Oh, just downstairs running my trains." And there was that tone in the voice, like, "I'm just in another world." And, you know, and you just interrupted it. No, but he's always been like that. And when I'm down there in the basement, when I get to visit him and those trains start going around the track, you can just see his mind. You can just see him just get transformed. And I can just stand back and enjoy the trains because he's in another world. He doesn't need conversation. And that's, stitching does that for an awful lot of people. You see people sitting in the lawn chair pictures, you know, I'm out on my deck and here's my view and I'm just stitching. And it's like, oh, heaven, thank you.
it's a really interesting topic, and it's the kind of thing that, so many, you know, just appreciating that for those who are stitching, or maybe even stitching right now as they're listening to this, just appreciating that we have this. And, you know, and I agree. So many 85-year-olds who sit around not knowing what to do with themselves, and so glad that your father has his trains, because it's an important thing.
Well, yeah. And that's the other part of it, is when you retire and don't have that paying job all day, rather than sitting around, you get to spend more time doing the thing you enjoy. And, absolutely. You know, that's my dad. Ever since he's retired, he has been able to spend more time with friends, helping them build layouts, helping them upgrade their layouts, work on his own, go to club meetings. He works at this hobby shop. He's 85 years old. And he works at this hobby shop in the drain department, has for, I don't know how many years. Mm-hmm. And it's not work.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's just in there talking to people about trains. If they buy something, fine, you know, he just, but that's where the value, and it's a lifelong value, you know, that you get out of this is a release while you're working. And then, when you retire, more time to do what's fun. And yeah, no, it's, always have been a firm believer in the hobby and the value of it beyond just a way to spend money.
But, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And you can, you know, and that's the thing about, like, model trains is not so much, and some of the other hobbies not so much, but needlework is, that's the other part of needlework as a hobby, is it's really very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of money. Now, and I'm kind of spilling some of the stuff that we talked about with Trish Burr, but she was talking about that when it comes to needlework, you can go to Walmart, wherever, buy a couple of 200 count pillowcases, a needle, and some sewing thread, and you can stitch.
Yep, absolutely.
Now, yep. You know, cut up that that canvas, get a little hoop or that linen, that pillowcase, cotton, linen, whatever it is, and you can stitch. There's not, you know, it's that simple. And you can create designs, you can follow patterns, you can do whatever you want. I mean, that's really very little monetary outlay for some hours of enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's one of the things that I've run into when, so for those who have followed me or know about me, my other passion is bobbin lace. And when I have talked to people or people have asked me about how do I get started and all of that, one of the challenges of bobbin lace is that it's not so easy to help somebody get started, because somebody says to me, I want to stitch. I could hand them a little piece of Aida and some DMC and, you know, get them off and running with basically no outlay. whereas something like bobbin lace is more complex to get started with. So the appreciation of needlework, whether it be
crossed. How do you keep track of all of those?
Well, when you start bobbin lace, you don't start with 100 bobbins.
Do you keep track of all those bobbins?
You keep them in order on your pillow. And you hope the pillow doesn't fall off the table.
No kidding, Arlene.
If it does, you deal with that, okay?
I would just cry. I'd just fetal position in the corner. I'd just cry. That'd be it.
You know, it's like a tragedy in the stitching world. If you, you know, most everything is fixable and you figure out how to fix it and you probably don't fix it in that moment. You need to step away and fix it 3 days later or something like that.
Yeah, when you cool off. Yeah.
Yes. But there, you know, there's little tricks and things to help. And the best one that I've ever seen is when that happened to somebody during a lace class. And it was more of like almost like a retreat setting than a formal class in just the needs of the students. And the one that this happened to, she was like ready to like throw the pillow out kind of thing. And the teacher said, give that to me. I'm taking it to my room tonight and I will take care of it for you. And the next morning she brought it back to the classroom and it was all rearranged all nicely. So that, you know, yeah, that happens sometimes. Okay. But back to my point is that there are some hobbies that are a little bit more challenging in terms of the startup costs, startup abilities. But there's plenty within the fiber arts world that are quite doable. And, you know, I love seeing kids get started and stuff. And I myself have taught literally hundreds of students to cross stitch. How many of them have kept it up? If a handful, that would be a lot. But at least I know I planted a seed, you know, and that alone is an important thing.
Well, and that's, you know, with that, if you have 100 kids that you teach cross stitch to, and a year later none of them are doing it, you're exactly right. You planted a seed, and someday along the way, you never know when that sprouts, and then you've got someone who now has that hobby that gives them the experiences that we all have. And if you hadn't taken those, you know, that time to do it, it would never have happened. And yeah, that's you got to seize those opportunities, and because you just never know. It's just a neat thing about this hobby, but you are able to get into this hobby with minimal cost. And that's the other part, is you can go to a whole lot of designer sites and there are free charts, patterns of all needlework types. that you can download, so you don't even have that expense, and some DMC floss, and you can have at it.
Yep.
And yeah, it's I know that designers put them up. Oh, I threw this little thing together, and here's some simple instructions, and I'll just put it up and make it free. And then I'm moving on to the designs that I'm going to sell. But it's those little designs that make the hobby approachable. It allows people to take a shot at it. And still one of my favorites, and it's still up there, is Debbie Rowley has a design on her homepage that if you sign up and put your name on her email list, you can download the design. And I did that and stitched that thing and had it put into a wooden jewelry box for our daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. And you know, just a little 4x4 design and typical Debbie Rowley stitches and some Krynek and all kinds of things. And it was a nice little challenge. It was a quick put together and put into a wooden jewelry box. It's just a beautiful little thing. And, it cost me some thread. That was it. And yeah. Yeah, it's a very approachable hobby. It really is.
Absolutely.
Yep. Linda Eaton Winterthur was anxious to talk to you because had such a great time chatting with her.
Uh-huh.
And I know that you have been to, what, 3 of the past 4 of the conferences?
Not exactly. I have the booklets that have gone with them.
Are you saying, Arlene, that once again I've done a podcast and didn't have the facts all lined up? Are you saying that to me?
Not have the facts correct. I clarify the facts for you. I was at the last one that happened in 2016, and then the first one that I went to was in 2008. They did not have a booklet to go, or a brochure, booklet is what I'm calling them, because they're, you would call it a catalog, but it's so small, it's not, you know, a catalog of the exhibit that is small, I'm referring to as a booklet, okay? So I learned about Winterthur probably because of advertising that I saw for these symposiums is the word that or a conference. No, I'm looking at one of the brochures. It does say a Winterthur Needlework Conference. The first one I went to was in 2008, and I know there was one in 2005. I don't think that was the first one. There might have been one 3 years earlier than that. If I saw advertisements for them before then, I don't remember. But I definitely saw advertisements for the 2008 one. And it was just one of those things that I was intrigued enough and intrigued enough and intrigued enough. And I just decided I need to figure out how to make this happen for me to go. It was the first I'd heard of Winterthur. I live about an hour and a half away from there, so it's not incredibly far. And it has just become a place that I just think is amazing. And I really wish I lived closer to take advantage of some of the other things, events, lectures, things that go on at that place. So I was so glad that you had an interview with her. I'm so glad she's coming back a second time. But I've been there a number of times, and I've been to see. So they did a needlework exhibit and had a conference in 2008, 2011. They were on this 3-year cycle, 2014. And then out of nowhere, I started seeing advertisements in 2016. And the math side of me said, that's not right. It's supposed to be every 3 years. But they seem to now have gone to an every 2-year cycle because they realized the popularity of the needlework. I want to say they have a furniture conference, a needlework conference, and a blah, 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 fill in the blank conference. I don't know what the third one is. And they had like a 3-year rotation going on. But now I think they also do one of those in the spring. The needlework is always in the fall. Somehow they've made it that they're now doing the needlework every 2 years. They started creating a booklet / catalog for the 2011 conference, because that is when they had the Plymouth jacket. And that alone is an amazing project. So I did not participate in the creation of it, but man, in retrospect, I wish I knew about it earlier enough that I could have participated a bit in it. There was a project spearheaded through Plymouth Plantation to create a jacket as a faithful reproduction of a 17th century embroidery as a woman's jacket would be. There are a couple of examples they were building off of, one from the Victoria and Albert in London, or maybe both of the examples were in the V&A. And it was, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but it seemed to be like somebody's small idea that just grew and grew and grew and grew. And it took a few years to create it. And one of the places it came to be on display was at Winterthur. Because that was such an amazing thing, they built an exhibit around it. They have so many amazing needlework pieces, some on display, but a lot in their collections. It's the kind of place that they just don't have everything out. I've been on tours there. I've done some of their behind the scenes stuff, where you could go like into the collections rooms and they bring out stuff. I did a lace tour there with a lace group. So we saw some of their lace that they have there. They don't have much, but they have some lovely, amazing things. So the jacket project was the first time they produced one of these booklets. And I believe Linda Eaton referred to a very generous donor who, basically said, you need to have something like this. And so since then, so the 3 out of 4 that you're referring to is that I've seen the last 4 exhibits and I own the 3 booklets that exist. And I've gone to 2 conferences. So there's all your math. Okay.
Okay. Out of that, I'm going to claim I was 85% accurate.
Sure. Why not?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I went to a conference in 2008. I went to the conference, 2 years ago in 2016. And it's, it's an environment that it's like in the same way that FlossTube opened up my world of knowing stitchers and knowing, the cross-stitch world in a way that I just hadn't been able to interact with before a year and a half ago. Going to the Winterthur Needlework Conferences opened up my eyes to an academic setting where people were talking about a level of needlework that I had not known that there were people interested in it, like academically. It wasn't all stitchers. There were people from the fields, colleges and universities, textile historians. And I found this so fascinating at one point, and I don't even remember which, I think it was the first conference I was at. It was like one of the lectures right after lunch. So the lectures are for everyone all at the same time. So they have the Winterthur has a great, so it's on acres and acres and acres of grounds that was Henry DuPont's estate. And there is a house which was turned into a museum. It's not a house. It's a mansion. It's gigantic. It's huge. And there's also galleries and everything like that. But they've built separately a visitor center. And within that visitor center, there is a huge lecture hall, which means they can hold conferences and have lectures and special events like this. So in this lecture hall, and there was probably about 200 people there, and it might have been Linda who actually did this, because I want to say it wasn't the speaker. I think she was getting ready to introduce a speaker. And she said, we were sitting at lunch with a group of people and we're having this great conversation. I just want to do this before I introduce the next speaker. I'm curious to know how many people in this room are actually stitchers. And this was just fascinating. So people raised their hand. I look around the room and I would say about 90% of the hands went up. But it was interesting that not 100% of the hands go up. There are people in the room that this was their interest, whether it be their job, their field of study, whatever, but they themselves were not stitchers or not identifying as stitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that alone was an interesting fact. And then the second follow-up question was, now keep your hand up if you learned your stitching or got your love of stitching or that came from a female relative. I mean, that, I guess, was the topic of really what the conversation at the lunch table was.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say of those hands, about 90% remained up. Now, mine did not. That's part of my own stitching story, how I would not say my love, all of this did not come from a female relative. It was not something I got from a mom, grandmother, aunt. That's a whole nother story. But I loved that conversations like that were happening at this conference, that
right.
People were talking about things like that. The exhibits that Winterthur has put on, there are, so I'm pretty sure I'm saying this correctly, of the four that I've seen, two of them have been in the, quote, larger exhibit space, and two of them have been in the, quote, smaller exhibit space. I will get down there at some point, hopefully in the next few weeks, because, of course, I will go see this exhibit, as well as just make a day of it. You know, there's lovely grounds. Henry DuPont, in his planting and planning of his estate, true, like part of his collecting was about American, his focus of collecting was American everything, really before the industrial age. So like from 1640 to 1840 is, I think, like what the tour guides tell you. Now that said, there's certainly been a lot of things that have been brought into the Winterthur collection since, you know, both past 1840 as well as since Henry DuPont died and, right, you know, continued on. So it's American focused. But you've got furniture, you've got decor, you've got paintings, you've got, and lots of textiles. So I just love this place that there's this beautiful appreciation. But in addition to the interior collecting he did, he also was a gardener, an appreciation of everything outdoors. So to go to Winterthur, you know, I'll have to say is you kind of want to go on a beautiful day because you want to spend time. you could do tours of the house. You can do just spend time in the galleries. When I could go on a weekday, they have a library there. And what I love is that it's open to the public. I mean, you have to sign in and show an ID and all that, but it is an open to the public library, and it's open stacks, meaning it's not one of those libraries that, you know, you have to special request and one book at a time and all of that. For the most part, you can go into the stacks and look for books. And the amount of books they have on needlework and textiles and the kinds of things that I'm interested, I more than once have spent hours in their library there. So this is my little advertisement for Winterthur. Go there, people, if you can. Really is a wonderful place. The exhibits that Linda Eaton has pulled together over these last number of years, it's almost like they Winterthur has so many wonderful needlework textile collections. It's kind of like they just could dip into to everything they have and say, let's pull together. Let's decide on the theme. Let's pull together what makes sense and let's go with it. And that, I mean, I think it's just wonderful. They have this amazing resource that I think you even asked the question in your interview, is anything borrowed? And this one special casket thing. But beyond that, I think all of these like the Plymouth jacket was this special thing a few years back. But beyond that, everything comes from their own collections.
That was something that I did not expect, because when I asked that question, I really was counting on going off on a tangent of learning how she goes about finding, acquiring, handling, and returning. Nope. And when she said, no, it's all our stuff, wow. Yeah. Yep. I mean, it just stops you in your tracks to think that she can do exhibitions and build conferences and workshops off of what they have. So the treasure trove has to be vast.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you can do one of the, like, they have all kinds of levels of tours. They have like the basic tour that, you know, if you're a first time visitor, they encourage you to do this kind of tour. But if you can go there, if you know, you have to kind of plan things. Anyway, if you could get a tour that gets you into something like the textile storage area or something like that. I mean, there are these, you know, those kind of drawers that you pull out that have like the glass over them kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could go in there, I mean, if you're on the right tour, and see some of these amazing things. And I feel like because I've been there enough times, I feel like the last exhibit I saw, and I'm like, oh, I don't remember seeing that piece in the storage room. Like, literally. I mean, obviously they have much more than what is available during that little tour. But there is just, they just have so much. They just have so much. And it's yes, that they can just pull from their own collections and just put things on display. It's just, it's phenomenal. It really is.
And you live an hour and a half away and you're not a fixture there, Arlene.
Well, yeah, if I didn't have to drive. I try to get down there. Well, certainly when they have some special exhibits, like one of the years that wasn't a needlework exhibit year was the year they had the costumes from Downton Abbey.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And that was a huge draw. I mean, they had to do time tickets, which, you know, Winterthur never does something like that. They had to do time tickets for that. That was huge. Now, I feel like I saw on their website they are getting an exhibit, some other costumes. What would be the time period? I think they're getting another big exhibit like this spring that might be another big draw like that. So I was down there this summer. I picked a day. I wanted to go down. I had a great few hours in the library. I got some inspirational ideas for some needlework patterns from that day. There, one of the exhibits, which I think is still there in the biggest of exhibit spaces, it's called, Dining by Design. I think I've got that title right. Here comes a great transition coming up. Are you ready for this one? There's an exhibit in Winterthur, which I think is still there, called Dining by Design. And it's got all like dinnerware and all like the history and all. And again, it's mostly all kinds of stuff that Winterthur owns, if not mostly, completely. And there was something in that exhibit that has inspired me to the canvas work pattern that I'm actually designing and working on right now. So from a day at Winterthur in an exhibit that I in no way would have thought would have been part of anything that would have inspired. I mean, this is what I love, is being able to go somewhere and see something. I'm like, oh my gosh, I could see a needlework pattern out of that. That's mm-hmm. really intriguing. There's a neat history behind what I'm seeing right now. Let me go research that some more. Let me do some sketches right now. Let me go somewhere with this. And it's something that, it's a design that I'm working on right now that, you know, and so a place like Winterthur is really an inspiring kind of place on so many different levels. So yeah, well worth the trip. Definitely.
An hour and a half and you're not there every other day.
Well, it's not a fun drive. I'm just going to put it that way. Okay.
Okay. You are going to go back and beat on your blog some more.
Okay.
Because the one you did, well, you've done two about changing patterns, but the one making a pattern your own, mm-hmm. where you took the Gene Hilton Scott Lee design,
yes,
and changed that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just talk about that, not in the context of stitching Scott Lee, but the changing of the patterns, because you've done, this is now the second one that you've shown. The other was a Curdy Biggs Threedles design where you did your own colors and took elements out.
Mm-hmm.
And the result in both of them, I really enjoyed, but it was, you know, I was reading that and looking at what you did, and in the context of getting people over the hump of changing a chart, say, you know, for purposes of discussion, a charted needlepoint piece,
mm-hmm.
a Gene Hilton, a Curdy Biggs, Debbie Rowley, whatever it might be, taking that, and as the title of your blog post was, making it your own. So getting away from, you know, approaching it, not, I want to stitch that because I really like the colors, but I want to stitch that because it presents something that's enjoyable to me, but I'd like to literally make it my own. I want different colors. I'm not sure these stitches here really I like, so I'd like something else there. But that's a big hurdle for people to get over, because the training isn't the right word, but I'll use it. Training expectation approach is to buy something and stitch it as designed. And most of these designers will encourage you to do whatever you want with it. And I know Debbie, for one, she puts a table up. Here's the threads that I used. And then there's an equal number of blank spaces for you to put down the threads that you want to use. Mm-hmm. So that's right in her design. You know, I expect you and encourage you to change it. So I just wanted to, the mental process that you go through, whether it's this, that Curdy Biggs one or this Gene Hilton one, that you go through when you see a chart that you like and want to change it, that would, you know, things that would help people get over that hump and feel comfortable at least exploring the option.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, there's no stitching police. There's nobody out there that's going to say you're doing it wrong, because you're not. That's like, you have to believe that you are not going to do it wrong. And I think one piece, like, to start with, and I think it even comes up in that Gene Hilton design as well as, you know, countless others. That Gene Hilton design is pretty old, and that, I'd have to take it out to see if I'm saying this correctly. Whatever the original publication date of it, I'm pretty sure it had some threads in it that no longer exist. And as I mentioned in the blog post, there's a store that worked with Gene Hilton's family and bought the publication, the copyright rights, and are, you know, free and clear, are printing her designs again. And I'm forgetting now whether the chart actually says in it, you know, such and such thread does not exist anymore, here is a suggestion for a substitution, or whether I just had to figure that out. Oh, that thread doesn't exist anymore. So, you know, if a person was picking up a chart and came, you know, Google it and figured it out, oh my gosh, that, you know, starting with that moment and realizing I literally cannot stitch this as charted because that thread doesn't exist anymore. Guess what? The world isn't going to fall apart. Okay. That, you know, like, that's like the first realization, is that it is perfectly okay. And I think there's some people that maybe just need to be told that. And I've had a couple of times where I've been sitting with some people at stitching events, and I have been the one to actually in effect tell them that, you know, it's okay if you are switching that color. And literally they've in effect thanked me and said, you know, no one's ever said that to me before. Mm-hmm. And so that's a helpful thing. I think the more people like you and I talking about it right now, as well as the more anyone talks about it at their group meetings or stitching nights or whatever, just the more that can get out there, that it is okay to make it, to decide, I like this pattern, but I want to do my bit. I love on FlossTube that I see lots of cross stitchers that love changing up patterns as designed.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there. I think that is increasing.
Yep.
Because I think people are seeing it and are encouraged and are becoming aware that it's okay. Because I noticed that too, more and more. I did this one, but I made this red a little deeper because I didn't really care for that red. And I did this, and I'm seeing that more and more. And I think that's fun.
And I'm getting ready to start this pattern, and this floss tuber did on this fabric, and that floss tuber did on this fabric, and here's a third person that did on a third different fabric, and it was so cool to see three totally different versions. So I'm going to do it on a fourth different color fabric. I mean, I love
yep.
that, you know, that kind of thing comes up more and more, or on Facebook, you can, you know, not that the search tools are that great, but sometimes on a Facebook stitching group, you can search the name of a pattern and you see it, you know, different people's versions of it, which is just wonderful. When it came to that Gene Hilton piece, as I wrote about, I'd first encountered it because somebody was blog stitching it. They were, you know, keeping a blog while they were stitching it. And it was the first time to my memory that I had ever seen something so complex. And I was so intrigued. But as I wrote, the colors just did not do anything for me. It just wasn't at all appealing to me.
Yeah. And I have to agree on that one. Of course, yeah, the colors you went with are right along the lines of my favorite, but yeah, that original set of colors. I'll pass too. Yes.
And it was some years, I couldn't tell you, two, three, more or less, I don't know, between originally seeing it and then learning about this store that bought the rights and were selling it. And I was so glad that Scott Lee was one of the designs they were selling. And I purchased the book, sort of no questions asked. So I'm going to do that. And I was, you know, I had no vision exactly what colors would I would like. It was just, I knew I didn't like those colors. And what inspired me for that particular design was in her introduction or writing about it, she wrote how she designed the rug. And I believe this is both the design as well as the color scheme inspired by, sorry, she designed the design was reflected off of a rug that her son owned. And I don't know if it was intended to be like an exact replica or is just inspired by, but seeing where her inspiration came from, like it was like a light bulb for me. I looked over to the rug that sits underneath my dining room table. And it's a rug that, you know, nothing fancy, nothing super expensive, but it took me a long time to find it because I was looking for like a certain color scheme. And I looked at the color scheme on that rug and I said, there's my color scheme. That's what I'm going to work off of to figure out how I'm going to change up the colors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have come to that idea had she not shared where the design came from. It came from a rug. One, I feel like you and Christine talked about this quite some time ago. One thing that I've used many times is, and it's a great tool, it's a great tip. If you are fortunate enough to have a local needlework store and you could go in and look at overdyed threads and talking about like the overdyes that have like multiple colors in them. And not that you would necessarily need one of those threads for a project, but if you go and look at a wall of threads and you look at one and say, wow, I like the colors in that thread. That's a color palette that's appealing to your eye. Like grab that thread and then go find the four or five solids that go with that. And maybe you only need the four or five solids in the actual pattern that you're stitching and you don't even need the over dye. But when I first heard somebody read somewhere, somebody using that tip, and the first time I had the opportunity to go to a store, I thought, oh my God, this is a great idea. Because this way to figure out color palettes that someone else has more or less figured out, that the dyers of those threads said, oh, this and this look good together. I'm going to put them into a thread. And again, more often than not, I'm not actually using that over dye within a pattern, but I'm using the palette. And that to me was another eye-opening moment at whatever point in my stitching career that I first started using that tip, that also kind of gave me permission to start exploring what are some other ways to play around with the colors that if something doesn't, the original picture doesn't appeal to me, so to speak. And as for like changing up a design, like to that's both of those two that you referenced are both cases that just as I was going along it, you know, that judgment call of, I know it says this stitch there, but it just looks too busy. It just look, you know, and I can even remember that from, you know, following along that person who I honestly cannot remember. I couldn't figure out who was blog stitching it years ago. I just remember thinking, this is a fascinating, challenging chart. I've never seen anything like this before. And yet it looks kind of busy. And I was trying as I was going along to kind of, for lack of better words, tone down the busyness of it. And I was just, and some of that is try this, nope, rip it out, try something else. Although I admit, I don't have too much patience with that. There's only so much that I will do in that vein. But it was a personal choice in both of those cases to take something that to my eye, and I just, you know, say personal opinion, other people can think differently. I respect personal opinion. To my eye, something that looked too busy, and just figure out how to change it so that it didn't look too busy to my eye. Or to, and in the case of the Scott Lee, as I was going along, I realized what the pattern called for in terms of leaving an area blank with blank canvas showing, which I think is a perfectly fine thing, because of the color scheme that I was using. It made the original look okay, but because of the color scheme that I was using, it really did look like too much blank canvas showing. So that's where I added in a very light background stitch. And that was just a case of my looking at and saying, yeah, this just looks right to me. And so there needs to be an element of a little bit of trust your own gut reactions. Be willing to try something, to recognize, and this is one of the things I've said a number of times about when I've tried out other hobbies, other crafts, other arts. I don't do the messy ones. Like, I don't do paint. I don't do glue. It's very well. And partially because they feel a little bit too, quote, permanent. Like, if you're trying to paint something or even trying to glue something and you kind of mess it up, sure, there's always ways to fix it. But let's face it, pulling out thread is a lot easier than trying to unglue something. And so there's always that relief that if something doesn't look right, you can pull out the thread. There's no harm done there. And that's just what I've always tried to encourage people to realize, that you can try something. And that's just, it's as I evolved as a stitcher over time, it was just the willingness to give things a try. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but you just got to give things a try. That's what I have to say.
Well, and the other thing that I've experienced in changing these things, and it was early on, that makes no sense at all. It was a couple, 3 years ago, it was a piece, a Debbie Rowley design. Sounds like that's all I stitch is Debbie Rowley, but that's not the case. It was one of those, I just didn't care for the colors, but I wanted it to, and I knew what I wanted it to be. And so I was at my local store, Welcome Stitchery, and Monica, the owner, I said, you know, help me. I want this to be this color scheme. Don't even remember what it was now. Still have it kitted downstairs. Never have stitched it. I want it to be this. Can you help me pull threads and find threads that will make that happen? And of course, sure. But the first thing she did was she started pulling the colors that were spec'd, mm-hmm. and laying them out. And I'm sure I looked at her like, wait a minute, didn't I just say? Mm-hmm. And she said, when she does that, she likes to pull what was spec'd and what we're seeing, because then that helps her see the weight of the color, the weight, thickness, whatever, of the threads mm-hmm. that were used for a given stitch, and whether there's crinic or silk, or whatever it might be. And then she lays those out, and then that gives you a reference point for the threads you're actually going to use. Mm-hmm. And in that, you know, she might have used number 5 pearl. You don't necessarily have to use that, but you know that it would look best, according to the way the design looks, if you use a thread of similar weight in terms of thickness. Mm-hmm. And if she used a crinic here, then you might want to consider something certainly that thick, but maybe also something reflective like a crinic might be. And so I thought that was a good plan because it laid out. And so when you walk out the door, you at least know that if all you're concerned about was changing the colors to something you liked, that you're going to be able to stitch that piece and have the various stitches come out looking the way that the design that you like it looks, but yeah. In your colors. And so I thought that was just a useful thing and something that I've kept in my back pocket as a way to address changing colors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, I mean, that doesn't, it does mean, it not doesn't mean, but it's really helpful when you have a physical store to go into.
Yes.
And have the ability to lay out all those threads and being able to play around with threads. There's no question about that. When I
item number 3,402 on the list of why we need to support local needlework stores.
Yes, absolutely. When I was playing around with my changes for the Curdy Biggs piece, I knew I had the sense of a color. I did go to a store that had a very large thread selection of all different kinds. And at first I was trying to do a little bit of match up thread thicknesses and so on. But I also knew that for that piece, I felt like there were too many threads that were used. And I wasn't going to use one of the ways I was going to my eye, tame down the busyness of it. And again, that was to my eye, to my personal opinion, was to eliminate as much variety as I thought was in there. But I actually ended up purchasing a fair amount of threads because I just wasn't sure which ones were going to work. And I could never do that if I was trying to do this online and, you know, trying to pick, you know, are these actually the same shades of blue? You know, I need a sparkly one and a silk one and a this one and a that one. And by being in a store, I could confirm for myself, yeah, these all work together. So yes, support your stores, people. That is so, so important. Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's increasingly an increasing number of people who would support a store but don't have one.
Yes,
and you know, that's problematic in its own right. And to me, that's where buying the thread cards, like the DMC card, multiple page card now that shows the actual threads in all of the colors, gives you at least something to start with. Mm-hmm. And I truly doubt that all of the thread companies offer that, but you might be able to, you know, I'm sure some do, but that's a nice little weapon. And even if you have the DMC, that gives you a reference point in terms of this color. Now, can I find that equivalent or something close to it in someone else's thread if you don't want to use DMC? That card is valuable, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I use mine all the time. And you can get color cards. Krynek and Rainbow Gallery has them. And one of the challenges with Rainbow Gallery is they have so many wonderful threads.
Yes, they do. That's a problem.
You know, to purchase all of the color cards they offer, yeah, that's a whole library in itself. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just a, you know, when you do that, and that's why I wanted to talk about it, because when you do that and post about it the two times, or now it's actually three times you posted about changing a chart, it comes across as a relatively easy thing. Yet for most people, it's a significant hurdle to get over. Even if they realize that, you know, number one, realizing it's okay to do that,
yes.
You know, that's number one. And, one thing that stuck in my head is when Christine and I were at Sassy Jack's and I was buying thread for a Hands Across the Sea sampler. And I didn't care for the specked linen. And I wasn't so sure I wanted to do it on 46 count, which was what Nicola had used.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of standing there at the counter, and Kim's on the other side. Kim Young, the owner, is on the other side. And I'm kind of hemming and hawing because I really like the end result of the higher thread count linen and the silk that was used with it. And I'm back and forth and back and forth. You know, do I really want to do that? And Kim just looked at me and she said, "It's your piece."
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, thank you for the wake up call.
Yeah.
Yeah, because exactly. Thank you, Kim. It is my piece and I can do it the way I want. And
absolutely.
And so I went with the 40 count and the threads I wanted to stitch with, and I know when I do it, I'm going to be happier for it. But yeah, it was just looked me right in the eye, said, "It's your piece." Yeah. Uh-huh. And people forget that. Yeah. You're not, there's nobody standing there, forcing you. Do it the way you want. Yeah. But yeah, to have a path to accomplish that is the next step. And I think for a lot of people that stops them. And yeah, gotta, and sometimes just gotta dive in. And that's that's the other part. As you stitch along through the years, you build up that stash of an extra skein from this project and two from this project. And, And if you're like me, you buy three colors and then discover you already own them. you know how that goes. And so you build that up. So then you start to have some stuff that you can play with that's right at hand. And because I don't know too many people can go out and buy all the DMC colors and all the Rainbow Gallery threads and colors. That'd be quite an undertaking.
Yes, but it would be an amazing stash to have.
Oh.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, if you had the temperature controlled warehouse to hold it, yes, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, Arlene, we're going to have to stop.
This is always fun and enjoyable to chat with you, Gary. Absolutely.
Right back at you. Always a treat. Always a treat. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. And now, Sunday, do not miss this. Trish Burr on Sunday. Do not miss it. I don't care if you've never done embroidery, have no interest in embroidery, don't miss it.
I won't be missing it, not at all.
It was an absolute treat to talk with Trish. What a wonderful lady, and of course, an incredible talent. So that's coming up Sunday. Arlene, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Gary, take care.